Welcome to another episode of The Telltale Heart, a cardiovascular digest for pharmacists. I'm Craig Beavers, your host, as always. And like I say every week, I have a really outstanding episode. Very excited about this. To let you know, and you may have seen some promos, we're actually filming live in the podcast studio. The first time this podcast studio is used at the MJH Life Sciences headquarters. So this is exciting for us, and I'm excited. The guest that we have today, it is an honor and privilege. I've gotten to know her for a long time and love to know and love her practice and what she's doing, but she also has a unique lens for what we're going to talk about today, and we'll get into that in a minute. Just a reminder, a couple housekeeping items. If you like this podcast, please like, subscribe, follow, rate us. It would be helpful. We like to have feedback. We like to tailor our content towards what is useful for you and how you would like to have information or content or things you would like to hear. Any feedback is great. You most certainly can reach out to myself. You can reach out to Pharmacy Times. You can put it in the comments. We just want to continue to make this podcast to be useful for pharmacists as they go through the process. So please, please, please give us any feedback. And with that, we'll jump into the episode or our content today. And we're going to be doing the narrative overview. If you've been following along, every time we have a large meeting, we kind of do some prep work and talk about what's going to be at the trial and what we're excited about. And then what I like to do, and I'll try to see if I can bring this guest back, is to say, what did you take from this, or how this information in trial? And I know there's things that are going to be presented that is definitely going to impact her practice, right from the start, potentially, mm-hmm. in a lot of people's practices. So with that being said, I want to introduce Dr. Kristen Campbell, friend, peer, to the podcast. Kristen, tell us, I've told your name, who you are, where you work, what you do.
Thanks, Craig. Yeah. I'm really honored to be here. Thanks for having me. I am a clinical pharmacist at Duke in Durham, North Carolina, and I work with the electrophysiology group. I've had many roles at Duke over the years, but this one is by far my favorite and the one I've been doing the longest. We do lots of really fun, unique stuff, and I work in both the inpatient and outpatient environment.
Sure. Can you expand? I've always appreciated, the role that the pharmacist can play in the electrophysiology space. And I think for some people, electrophysiology can feel scary, is the best term to put with this. Because if you think about historically the agents that we would use to manage, they are not fun or clean agents. They're the dirtiest of pharmacotherapies. And partly because, you're trying to target these channels, right, that exist in the heart, but also kind of exist elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And so that it's hard to really isolate them. And then, of course, they have all sorts of pharmacokinetic challenges and ties to them. So it makes it interesting. And of course, EP has evolved. I know, and maybe you can talk about how this is impacting your role or what it looks and change. I know we've gone to an ablation forward strategy in a lot of aspects in cardiovascular disease, and it would be interesting to see how the pharmacists work through that. But tell us, what are you getting to do on a day-to-day practice in your clinic, or what does it look like for you as you practice in this space?
Yeah. So to kind of take off of what you hinted to, the whole reason that I got here was because one of the attending physicians, EPs at Duke, he recruited for a pharmacist, and he said, besides oncology, we use pretty much the most dangerous medications that are out there. Right. And so why would you not want to have a pharmacist, which I think is a great credit to our field.
Right.
He didn't know me at the time, but that was how he advocated for getting a pharmacist. And we have a large practice at Duke. We have 15 attendings, so a very large population base. And for that, we have a rounding service. So I round with them every day, and we're taking care of people with AFib, with VT, device issues, device infections, things like that. But of course, because they're cardiology patients, they also have heart failure and they have hypertension and all the things. So we're still doing all of the regular cardiology things. But balancing that in with the complex medications is certainly a lot. And I also have a clinic where I monitor patients that we've started on antiarrhythmics. And I'm the liaison for our EP lab, so we're using a lot of medications there. And anticoagulation is obviously a big deal in the vast majority of our patients. So, you know, there's definitely still a role.
Sure.
I think we definitely are moving more to, I like to say, a rhythm-based approach, but certainly in the United States, ablation is a huge part of that. It's not in other countries, but it is here. But I would say that all of my attendings that do ablations would say that, first, definitely, none of what we're doing for AFib is considered curative.
Sure.
And many patients require more than one ablation, and many patients require a combination of ablation and medication.
Sure.
So there's still always going to be that need. And, you know, and then pharmacists are especially talented and poised through their education to point out the reasons why we need to be there.
Well, and I think the important thing to think through it, it's not just, yes, we're dealing with antiarrhythmics that are challenging as a whole, but then you think about things that can either provoke AFib or work through that, and there's medications and things that we get concerned about, or I want to pick your brain on this. Have you guys adopted kind of, you know, there's data out there with the GLP-1s, for example, about improving success for ablation. We know in the guidelines, you know, a 5 to 10% weight loss or BMI change helps better manage AFib, prevent or, you know, be successful with the management of that. Have you guys seen a large uptake? Has your EP practice been doing that strategy?
So definitely there is a correlation there, and data is very indicative that in people with a BMI over 40, we probably shouldn't even be offering them ablation.
Sure.
So we are definitely picking up on the GLP-1s. As you know, they have they're intensive in how you have to titrate them and start them. And to be honest, most EPs aren't really comfortable doing that. So we do a lot of referral back to general cardiology and PCPs. But there are times where we are initiating it. There's always a patient circumstance where, you know, they need help and you're the one that's in front of them. So we have a great system at Duke. We have a cardiometabolic pharmacist that we recently just hired, and she's helping with a lot of those initiations and dose titrations and all of those types of things, because it is just absolutely necessary, and it allows us to offer patients the things that, you know, we know will help them.
At our site, the EPs have been the four leaders in using the GLP-1.
Yeah.
Like, they are referring to our cardiometabolic clinic to do that, and so I've done more work titrating for our EPs, or they were asking,
right,
how can we do this? So it's been, you know, kind of interesting to see. They're the early adopters.
I agree at Duke. I think it's been the same way, but we are also seeing a huge increase in heart failure and in our transplant population, where it's helping people become eligible for transplant.
Very good.
So it's a huge role. And I think Duke has seen that opportunity. A lot of institutions are seeing that opportunity to collaborate with each other.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of our patients that have refractory arrhythmias are maybe being evaluated for transplant. And so then we bring in the cardiometabolic pharmacist, and, you know, things get done.
Yeah,
that way.
It's awesome that it's created such a great opportunity for pharmacists.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I know you've already alluded to some of the great programs and things that you've put in there between your clinic and the efforts that you do. And I love where you mentioned, you're like, oh, we're a liaison for the EP lab. I think people also forget these procedures require or have medications in them. So it's not even just like, oh, we're doing antiarrhythmics and there's a process to this. And you mentioned, obviously, anticoagulation is very important in these patients. So it's not just, oh, we're going to do antiarrhythmics inherently. Well, these patients are going to need some form of strategy from that standpoint. And of course, I think there's a lot of roles, and we won't get into this, but as devices have come out and the ability to detect arrhythmias, you're probably seeing more and more volume of
patients
that are coming through for this. So I think that's fascinating. So I want to kind of also, before we get into the meat of the content, where we're going to talk about the American College of Cardiology meeting that's coming up, I know you have some unique roles within some societies, and I think it's always nice to highlight how pharmacists are impacting globally the process for our patient care and educating our pharmacists. So before we jump into ACC, and I know you have a big role there, you're also a part of the Heart Rhythm Society, which, if you want to explain to people who may not know what the Heart Rhythm Society is and what you've been able to achieve or work with on that process.
Sure.
Yeah.
Heart Rhythm Society, or HRS, is the EP society. It's international. And, you know, the focus is for people providing care in EP with a mission of number one, preventing sudden cardiac death as the main thing, but obviously treating AFib and all the device management and things like that. And I, for the last year and a half, I've been really privileged. I applied and was selected to serve on the Board of Trustees. And I'm the first pharmacist to be in awesome. That role. And then I represent the entire allied professional cohort of HRS. And so in the board meetings and in the work that I'm doing with committees and things like that, I'm really trying to advocate for every allied professional and make sure that, you know, voices are heard and representation is given and all of that. And HRS is certainly very open to that. So it's not like I'm having to convince them. It's more as a society sure. what we're trying to do. So
that's awesome. I mean, it's just such an honor and privilege to have you being there serving and representing pharmacists and advocating for ways that we can be, and the whole team, you know, clearly a part of this complex care process. And of course, as you have alluded to, arrhythmia, patients that are, you know, have a history of arrhythmias, it's a very challenging process. I don't think people realize, you know, they struggle with it potentially lifelong or, you know, to your point about recurrence or things that happen. It is so complex. And I think going to my original point, I think it scares people because it could be life-threatening, but it's just complex, right? And you're dealing with, you know, and we talked about channels and the drugs and how they work and understanding that process. It was always the thing I found fascinating, but never, you know, I got not nervous about EP, but maybe a little frustrated.
Feels you're like gray.
Yeah. Kind of gray. And the trials are tricky because, you know, how they enrolled them in some of the historical ones, if we talk about Affirm and that whole piece, but then, you know, can be frustrating because some of these therapies, either patients can't tolerate them or they're not as successful or trying to, you know, I don't know if that's what you've or felt your experience. It just is, you know, it's not like managing a blood pressure where you, and that, I'm not saying that that isn't tricky, but you can see some progress with that sometimes. And you may not immediately see that with the right. heart rhythm patients. So.
Right. Yeah. You know, I tell a lot of learners, you know, you like cardiology in a lot of ways because, you know, you have building blocks of therapy or pillars and things that, you know, you ideally want to treat the patient with. And then you can also say, if I give you this medication, you know, data in 20,000 people says that you're going to live longer by taking it. And it's more black and white. Obviously, there are a lot of other scenarios, but certainly compared to EP, it's a little bit more structured. Whereas EP, I mean, in AFib, everything that we do is guided by safety first rather than efficacy. That's very backwards thinking in a lot of ways to what people have learned.
Right.
And so it's unfamiliar.
Right.
And that makes it a little scary. I personally love it because it means that you have to really think and, you know, weigh the pros and cons and risks and benefits and all of that. And I love that part.
Right. And what is interesting to me is, you know, from a pharmacotherapy perspective, EP has not evolved drastically. And what I mean by that, there's not been like 1,000 new shit, but you're still working with, you know, the older ones. And there's other evolutions of things that have been helpful, like we talked about with GLP-1s. And of course, anticoagulation is continually changes and evolves. And we'll talk a little bit about how that may change too with the ACC piece. So let's transition into that. So among your other hats, and the reason we're excited to be here today is we're previewing ACC 26, the American College of Cardiology meeting that's occurring at the end of March in New Orleans. It is going to be March 27th, the Friday, and going through that weekend. So you also have a unique role in this aspect. And so you guys are hearing from someone with a privileged lens to tell you all the great things that are going to happen at ACC. So tell everybody what your role in terms of planning ACC is.
So I'm very lucky. I am serving as the CVT team lead for ACC 26 and 27. The way that ACC sets up planning the meeting, there are two physicians and then one member from the cardiovascular team. And we have literally built the meeting from the ground up. And we obviously have a huge group of people that are doing a lot of work with all of the different tracks and pathways and all of that. But ultimately, it's really the three of us working with the amazing ACC staff and planning the meeting and trying to make it, you know, the most exciting and engaging meeting that all attendees can have.
Yeah. No. So I'm excited to get into that content. I think maybe I want to start out with what a lot of people get excited about, and I think it's definitely important to get people engaged in this, is what is going to be some of the late breaking clinical trials or featured research that is going to be on there. I think one of the high level ones that everyone's excited, I know potentially, I think you'll be excited about this. I know I am, both from my hat as a pharmacist that practices, but also as I'm a CV service line leader in our institution, is the Champion AF study. And do you kind of want to insight what the Champion AF study is looking at? And
sure. So it's looking at the latest left atrial appendage occlusion device, Watchman Flex, mm-hmm. Which we've had Watchman for years now. And this is a more flexible device, and so a little bit more stable in placement, and comparing it to the DOACs. The first trials compared it to warfarin. And so now we know that DOACs are preferred for anticoagulation, if at all possible. And so this is, you know, one that is a real question in providers' minds and in patients' minds. We have a lot of patients come to us that say, I don't want to take a blood thinner and I can get this procedure and not have to. And we'll see what Champion AF shows. But before that, we could always say, well, you know, that data is compared to warfarin. And if you can take a DOAC, we don't know that that's just as good,
sure,
or non-inferior to a DOAC. And we know that DOACs are better than warfarin. So this is going to be a real practice impact, I think, regardless of the outcome in terms of how we present this procedure.
I think what's interesting, and for those who are not aware, the left atrial appendage is in AFib, you know, because you have the fibrillation going on, the likelihood of the blood pulling in stasis is in this left atrial appendage. So that's where a lot of the stroke that you see with atrial fibrillation comes from and generates. And so that's why you put this device to kind of cage in that area and prevent the thrombus from moving out and preventing it that way. And historically, just if people aren't aware, and you're like, why are they talking about a device? Why, this is a pharmacy thing, but it really is very pharmacy heavy for a couple of things, because historically it's been indicated for people who are high bleeding risk or cannot tolerate anticoagulation. Is that correct?
So that's interesting, and we can get into the weeds on it, but probably don't have time. But the trial was done really in low risk,
sure,
and, you know, some higher risk patients. The way that it was accepted into practice in the United States was high risk.
Yes.
And so that's currently where we are.
Right.
But I don't know that will change drastically. My understanding of Champion AF is you can have a lower CHADS VAS score of 2, even just to qualify you for needing anticoagulation. But they also have excluded heart failure and, you know, things like that, that there's still going to be a lot of people that it's not the right choice for.
Sure. Yeah, so. Absolutely. And it's just, you know, it is comparing against DOAC, and we know that direct-acting oral anticoagulants have really shown themselves very promising and is successful in atrial fibrillation, reducing the bleeding risk. And so really understanding what that is going to be. And this builds off a couple other trials that have occurred in this space. I think they had about 2 years ago, the OPTION trial, which looked at doing this with an ablation strategy.
Right.
And how that ties into that. And then I think there was a similar design looking at not just the Watchman, but all left atrial appendages that were at AHA. And it actually DOAC actually performed better. And so it's, who does try it?
This is not a given. So
granted, there were some questions about the methodology or limitations, but prior to AHA, I was like, Champion is going to be positive. There's no way it can't be positive. But that other trial did not show it to be positive. And so now I'm like, whew, it'll be interesting to see what Champion shows.
The DOACs are full of surprises, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even, you know, there were the early trials looking for valves and not great there. So, you know, it's interesting. And then we may get these factor 11. It's, who knows where we'll be after that.
Right. And so that could all change the whole paradigm again. So that it's constantly evolving in that whole space. And, you know, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that works. Of course, some of the factor 11A, they're looking at patients who can't be a candidate for either DOAC or Watchman,
right,
for that matter.
Right.
And so, you know, this space always just, probably of all your practice, the anticoagulation is the thing that changed.
And now, not that we're going to get into it because they have separate trials, but there's been a lot of trials about when do you stop anticoagulation after an ablation, or what does that look like? And I don't, you know, I think people need to appreciate how complex that is. And there is a role for pharmacists in that process, right? And understanding or why they need to understand this process and what that looks like from that aspect. So that's a big one. Is there other trials that you're kind of excited about besides Champion?
Yeah. I mean, we have quite a few coming out. We have the, I'm not even sure, HIPETHOS. And that's for PE. And I think that, you know, we're going to see a lot of exciting PE stuff. And so I'm looking forward to that. There's some great sessions on lifestyle and dietary measures that I think are going to be really important. We, you know, with GLP-1s and things like that, those types of things kind of have fallen by the wayside, but they, you know, they have the potential to show some good impact. So I think that's really good.
But I think those are important points because, for example, with cardiokinetic metabolic disease, and I know we're anticipating the guidelines for those to be coming out, but even in the scientific statement, they still talk about, it's not medication for it alone. It's always diet and lifestyle.
Right.
And even in stage zero, that's the whole focus. But then you build upon that where you're still doing the appropriate process. And then, of course, depending on what their comorbidities are, if they're, you know, in that CKM, they have hypertension, or what does that look like in managing? So I love that you're saying that, you know, this whole part of preventive cardiology, we need to not forget about.
Right.
It's very important from that aspect.
Yeah.
So
some other ones we have are spironolactone and HFpEF. That's going to be, I think, a big one, Spirit. And then there's another discontinuing beta blockers.
Sure. And if you hadn't heard that all day from ESC, there was two trials there. And we talked about that with Rob DiDomenico and Caitlin and Robert Page. They were my guests without immunity.
Love that.
And so we had this whole, you know, two trials. And of course, you know, everyone was thinking we were going to get answers to this question. And of course, still confusion.
Yeah.
And so now we have
yet another way.
We try to figure this out. And I don't know, what do you hope to see maybe out of this discontinuation?
I don't know. I think, I think either way, it hopefully we will get something that can guide us a little bit more directly, you know, and not have conflicting data as much, something that gives us direction. You know, it's always good to get patients off of medications if they aren't going to benefit from them anymore. But, you know, if it does turn out that they're needed, then it's good to know that and feel good about it. I mean, we've been doing this debate with dual antiplatelet therapy for years too, right?
Right.
And so I think in this world of polypharmacy and as we treat people better and they live longer, looking at if medications could be stopped at some point is an important aspect.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, because inherently at this day and age, CKM, heart failure, there, you know, there's good polypharmacy in the sense of things you have to do, but it's still polypharmacy, right?
Right.
And so figuring out where we can de-escalate therapy is definitely important.
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah.
So let's go back a little bit to the SPIRIT trial. So this is looking at spironolactone and HFpEF. If this is a trial that's come out of Journey, there's actually two versions of a spironolactone study coming out. This one is the first one to be coming out. You know, it'll be interesting to see what they ended up at. From my understanding, there's some rumors that they may not have gotten enough patients or there's some power issues that I don't know. We'll see what the presentation shows. But I think a lot of people are looking at this because, A, we're still trying to understand what the role is of these, you know, spironolactone in the HFpEF population. You know, what does that look like? Because we've had TopCat, which did not show promise, but then we have Fine Arts with the non-steroidal agents. And so trying to understand the role of MRAs as a part of that process. We know there's a role, but is a difference between steroidal or non-steroidal? What does that look like from that standpoint, knowing, you know, spironolactone has been cost-effective for years, but has side effects? So I don't know if...
We just need help in HFpEF. You know, we have so much data in HFrEF, and we know that so many people have HFpEF, you know, that really was underdiagnosed. And knowing now the things that we know about it, we need data. And so it's very exciting to get a trial. I don't know specifics about the enrollment and statistics and things like that yet, any more than anybody else does. But I hope that it will work out, that it will give us some answers.
Absolutely. And, you know, TopCat had you know, its own inherent problems that we all like to talk about and would like to see be done differently. And so I think part of that goal is to try to clear some of those questions up even. And maybe it will help reframe TopCat a little bit differently. From that standpoint. So it'll be interesting. And then, you know, I think the other thing that I'm excited to kind of see about, and, you know, this is, I think, maybe in one of the sessions that you're also moderating a featured research session. I think they're going to provide more data on, we've had lots of data, obviously, on GLP-1s in renal disease. You know, you talk about flow with semaglutide and so forth, but I think this is the first time we're going to get additional data of tirzepatide in a renal, kind of renal outcomes based on some of their studies. So I think that will be helpful to think through that process. And I think the other one that I'm interested in, I can't remember if this is in your session or not, but there, you know, we've had several years ago, the barbershops.
Yes, it is in my session.
That was looked at pharmacists in Los Angeles area, going out and going into the community, going into the barbershop, taking blood pressures, having a protocol to manage blood pressures. And we've not seen a large uptake in places of this type of strategy, which I think would be an amazing process and definitely great for pharmacists to see. But I think there is a version of this about community linkage to the barbershop and expanding this whole process. So I don't know if they've given you insight of that, but I know it's...
Yes, it's on untreated hypertension.
Right.
So the idea is the barbershop conversations, if there, you know, could be some type of educational point in there of the importance of being evaluated for hypertension and, you know, and then even the follow-up of like what was done in the first famous study. I think it's an amazing opportunity and... getting, you know, that is something that pharmacists at any level can do in any practice, right? And go out and make a difference. And then, you know, there's other places that we can be expanding it to outside of barbershops as well, you know.
Communities.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So I'm hopeful that it will have, you know, the barbershop study when it first came out was so fun, you know, in weird pharmacy nerd way of the design and the process of it. And so I'm kind of hopeful that they're going to have some other new fun stuff that they've implemented that will give more ideas and hopefully strengthen the data for it that we can get funding to try to get this actually implemented more frequently.
So Kristen, let's, you know, obviously there's a lot of great science that is going to be at ACC. They always do a great job at the American College of Cardiology meeting. I encourage people to go to the website and you can look at the late breaking clinical trials. You know, it's always a good thing if you're planning to come to the meeting or curious about the meeting to go look into that. So let me ask you this question, and obviously putting your planning hat on and obviously you're a pharmacist, why should a pharmacist attend the American College of Cardiology meeting?
I think, you know, one of the things that I've always said about ACC is that they have this very firm belief and really put their money where their mouth is of including everyone that is part of care for patients in the cardiovascular space. And so I feel so much I don't really know how to say it. So much just welcome and you know, collaboration. And it's so great that you're here. And it really is a great example of multidisciplinary care. Sure. And so I love that. There's obviously going to be a lot of sessions that focus on medications. So there's a lot that you can learn. You can get CE. We're very, very proactive of counting pretty much any session that mentions a medication. It could be pharmacy CE. So, you know, you can find yourself in a session where you're learning about, you know, procedures, but it's going to count for pharmacy CE because they were going to talk about the meds that they should be on afterwards, that type of thing. There's amazing networking opportunities between just other pharmacists that are attending, as well as, you know, if you're at an academic institution, you'll see previous fellows and, you know, end up, you know, socializing and making new friends and, you know, potentially collaborations for the future. It's a very welcoming environment in that sense. We do have the pharmacy or the CVT section reception where you can go and meet people, and that's great. We also have the pharmacy resident session. So that has changed a little bit this year. We did move those into the regular poster session, but we will still have a highlighted session with the top three or four posters that were voted on by the reviewers. And so it's a, you know, a great time to just connect with pharmacists in general and have some fun too.
It's always, the networking is great. It's always great to see friends like yourself and be down there. I think what is also spectacular, to your point about the poster session, there's always great things that you can see what people are doing at other sites and institutions. You know, I always advocate, or my opinion, and I know you and I have had a long, rich history with the ACC, and maybe we're a little bit biased, but the, you know, the content is really for anybody, you know, even if you're not dedicated to cardiovascular disease like you and I are, but you may be doing general work, or even if you're in the community or something to that effect, you know, it impacts all of us, cardiovascular disease. And so attending is a great way to get there. So I encourage you, if you aren't, you know, if you can be down there or go, you know, go check it out if you have the opportunity to go. If you can't, you can most certainly get the content after the fact and purchase it that way. But then I know Pharmacy Times will be working in collaboration with the ACC, as you can see. They're partners to help deliver and get that content to folks. And so I think that that is a great way. Do you have, just for you, if you are a pharmacist that is going there, Kristen, what are some tips and things that you would encourage for somebody if they're going to attend the ACC meeting?
Wear comfortable shoes. If you're doing it right, you're walking a lot. You're on your feet a lot because you're moving from session to learn as much as possible. You're running into people. You're going to grab coffee to catch up. That you're really busy, and so you definitely want to go in prepared. Plan the sessions that you want to go to ahead of time. Reach out to people that you think might be there so that you can make time to connect and, you know, get all of the opportunity that you can. We have tracks and things where you can look for your area of interest, but don't just go there. You know, if me as an EP pharmacist, I always say I'm actually probably better off attending everything but the EP sessions.
Sure.
Because that's my bread and butter every day. So look outside of your comfort zone and learn something new. Be exposed to something new, and don't be afraid to jump into the personalized skill zone or go into the escape room or participate in the game shows, because it's fun and you will also learn something at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, they have great learning formats that are unique and novel. And again, it's a busy, jam-packed 3 days.
Yeah.
But it's worth it. I always feel, you know, more excited and refreshed after leaving. I know that sounds weird to be going through a jam-packed meeting and feel refreshed, but it's, you get ideas, you meet people. It's a great process.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, we will continue like we normally do to cover this content as ACC unfolds. We're going to be doing some things live down at ACC and trying to be engaged in that sense. But then obviously we always have the follow-up and conversations. We're still doing follow-up for AHA at this particular juncture and working through that. So it, you know, as science unfolds and we figure out what we can do and how pharmacists can play in that role, it's a great process. But yeah, it's a great meeting for pharmacists. I, you know, again, Chris and I have had the luxury and the privilege to be engaged with ACC and get to see it from all different angles. And they really do strive to be a team-based care organization and focus on that. And you do appreciate the value every pharmacist plays across the domains, whether it is in clinic or in the hospital or in retail or the community set or a managed care for that matter. It all connects to that same point. So, Kristen, this has been outstanding. You have a lot of great insight and a lot of great diverse experience. So I appreciate you taking the time to come to the studio.
I'm so excited to be...
We'll honor you ring with that. Yeah. So if you have not listened to our podcast, or you have, always ask non-clinical questions, because I like for people to realize that we are also human beings and we do other things besides pharmacy or cardiovascular disease. So is there a current book or music or watch, something that you're really like, this is amazing, I would recommend this to somebody at this current time?
Let's see. I am a big fan of the Heated Rivalry series that's been out on HBO.
Yeah. Everyone's talking on this. I have not watched it yet.
Yes, it's definitely, it's good. And ultimately, what I will say about that show is it's a show about acceptance.
Yeah.
And we need more of that in this world today. So that would be the reason that I would advocate for that. I just finished a book that's not new, but was very... impactful. I know it's called A Little Life. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's about 10 years old, but it follows a group of four guys that meet in college and basically stay friends their entire lives. really, really good. And then as far as music, I have three kids and they're older. And so I am all over the place with what I'm listening to. So, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, I have a 13-year-old daughter, so we're all Taylor Swift. And then my 20-year-old son has discovered the Beatles and is obsessed. And so we're, you know, we're all across the board. But I actually really love that. I think that music is a thing that unites us.
Well, it's funny, and you'll appreciate this, and she's been on our podcast, but I was listening to my Spotify the other day, and the song came on. I was like, oh, this is a great song. And I like looked at it, and it was Harrison Finks, which is Shannon Finks. And I have to look up the track, but I can text Shannon. Shannon's a cardiology pharmacist friend of ours, and she works in Memphis. You can go back in our log. She's presented about her. She has a concierge medicine clinic that she does.
That's amazing.
Her husband and everything. But anyways, it was just like, oh, Shannon, your son, because he's been in the music and stuff and played on the Grammys and did all this stuff. But that's, it was just cool. Funny that you're like, oh, that's random song that I like. There's your
yeah,
song.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Well, bringing it back to ACC 26, we are doing some sessions on concierge medicine.
Okay.
And linking that into our AI intensive. So we're doing a lot of stuff about AI.
It's a big thing, and definitely a different type of angle of content to be thinking through from a practice standpoint. Well, I appreciate your time, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
As always, we appreciate you joining us. If you could, again, like, subscribe, message us, give us some feedback if you like this, what we're going to do. And then, again, Kristen, after the meeting unfolds, we'll try to bring you back on or figure out what you take away from that process. So we appreciate you being here. And as always, thank you all.